Okay, so today I'm going to bring us to the world of youth violence, where I think there's more agreement that kids who are in high school shouldn't be carrying knives and weapons if we can help it. And so this is a study looking at some social factors that we might think about at a community level that could make a difference in whether our kids are carrying guns and knives. I have no relationships to disclose. And I want to acknowledge all of my co-authors who are all at one time from the Harvard Injury Control Research Center, including David. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what is collective efficacy and some of the other neighborhood social processes that we've looked at in this study. I'll show you the methods of our Boston Data Project, talk about the findings and the discussion. So collective efficacy has its roots from Albert Bandura's work on perceived self-efficacy. So that is defined as the belief in one's capabilities to organize and execute the courses of action required to manage perspective situations. So what that means at a collective level is that neighbors feel like the people around them would work together, that there's trust in the neighborhood, and that they would work together for issues, specific issues that they would want to see changed, such as, and you'll see the items that we ask in the scale. So the scale is comprised of two parts: informal social control, which is when we ask people the likelihood that their neighbors could be counted on to intervene in various ways if children were misbehaving, skipping school, hanging out on street corners, spray painting graffiti, showing disrespect to adults, fighting in front of their homes, and then a really community mobilization if a fire station were threatened to be defunded. And then that's combined with issues about social cohesion and trust. So they're asked how much in their neighborhood people are willing to help, whether it's a close-knit neighborhood, whether they can be trusted, that people get along with each other, and that they share the same values. So you can see in our data that collective efficacy does vary a lot by the large neighborhoods in Boston. I'll show you how we subdivided those neighborhoods into smaller units for our study. But roughly, if you look at the Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan areas, that's where the highest concentration of poverty is in Boston. Yet, it's actually some of the highest levels of collective efficacy in Boston, too. So within those neighborhoods where we see the most crime, including gun crime, that's also places where people are really working together. And so this is an idea about, you know, showing some evidence that this can make a difference in kids caring. So collective efficacy has been now associated with a lot of different things, all in the direction that we hope. So originally, Rob Sampson published work from the Project on Human Development in Chicago Neighborhoods showing that it's associated with lower rates of violent events. We did a very similar study to the one I'm showing you today in Chicago with David and some of our other colleagues, showing that this was true in Chicago, that there were lower rates of firearm carrying by youth who lived in neighborhoods with higher collective efficacy. And now I'm going to show you that that's the case for some behaviors in Boston. Other positive things, such as later onset of first sexual activity, mental health, school outcomes, substance use outcomes, intimate homicide rates, some more school outcomes. We did work on less aggressive behavior among youth, lower dating violence victimization in both Chicago and Boston. And then this is the one that we're talking about now. So we looked at two other in neighborhood social processes. Given our limited time, I'm going to just briefly define them. They didn't show significant findings for us. The first one is intergenerational closure, which is really how much the parents are connected within a neighborhood. They know the children in the neighborhood. They know the parents of the other children. It's been associated with a lot of positive things. And then reciprocal exchange is really about doing favors for each other in the neighborhood. And this is strong. The items are very close to a lot of social capital scales for that one. So the methodology is, we call this project the Boston Data Project. And it originated when we had a Harvard Youth Violence Prevention Center. And it was in partnership with lots of different agencies, the mayor's office, especially the Boston Centers for Youth and Families, our public health department, our public schools, the police, and then 11 community agencies that partnered with the Youth Violence Center, as well as other universities. So in 1997, our soon-to-be outgoing mayor, Menino, was doing some surveys in the summer jobs program, which was a very limited sample. It was not representative of all the kids in Boston public schools. And so they came to us and they said, you know, help us make a more representative sample where we could really find out how much exposure to violence and violence perpetration kids are at. And so we did that first survey in 2004 of a representative sample of Boston youth in public high schools, which we've called now in multiple waves the Boston Youth Survey. And in 2006, we did that again, and then a neighborhood survey, which was a telephone random digit dial survey of adults in Boston neighborhoods. We did both of them again in 2008, which is where the data come from for this study, and then we did the neighborhood study in 2010. So in the Boston Youth Survey then, we did originally two-stage sampling where we sampled a whole list of schools and then classrooms within those schools. In the most recent data that I'm talking about today, we did simply inviting all schools, there were 31 that year in Boston, and then within each school sampling randomly classrooms stratified by year, 9th through 12th. And so we got a mix of what are called in Boston non-exam and exam schools, and there's the sample sizes of the 3 years, three waves, and then we geocoded everything to the nearest cross street. So we asked every child who filled it out to tell us what's the nearest cross street to where you live, and then we geocoded about 90% of the surveys that way. Our Boston Boston Neighborhood Survey then, like I said, was an RDD telephone survey, proportional to neighborhood size in the sampling, and those are the sample sizes. And these were geocoded to exact address because the survey research firm had the participant's address. We've also linked data from the U.S. Census and from the police department to this database. And then in terms of taking those neighborhoods, which have, you know, about 200,000 residents in them each, we brought those down to, we wanted to get, you know, more meaningful neighborhood clusters. So we started with this 156 census tracts. Boston also often uses 69 authority planning districts, and then there are the 16 neighborhoods that you saw on the map. So we took those maps to community leaders, and they helped us group these census tracts into meaningful clusters, and we did two sets. We have one that are much smaller number of people per cluster, and one that's N of 38 clusters, which is what I'm using here. So just as an example, this is a map of Roxbury, and you can see how many clusters we ended up with out of one of the big 16 neighborhoods. So the survey covered lots of, I don't know what that is. The survey covered lots of different topics. I'm going to focus here on some of the violent perpetration, which we defined as carrying knives or guns. I've described the predictors already. And so you can see here the prevalence of the weapon carrying in the past 12 months that we found among the sample of close to 1,500 public high school students. Public high school students in Boston are a very diverse sample. This is about 65% kids of color, and like I said, 9th through 12th grade. So you can see that boys were carrying both knives and guns more often than girls. And there are pretty strict, a lot of the schools, high schools have metal detectors and things, so we weren't that surprised that the carrying gun at school was quite low, less than 2% for boys and girls. All right, so multi-level, multivariate findings then, the predictors of carrying a knife anywhere past 30 days. We did not get any significant results for any of our neighborhoods' social constructs. But carrying a knife to school in the past 30 days, we found that for one standard deviation higher in especially the social cohesion half of collective efficacy was associated with a much lower likelihood of a 40% reduction in the likelihood that they'd carried a knife in the past 30 days. Similarly, when we looked at gun carrying, in both of these tables, only boys did we see significant findings, not for girls. And so in this table, we're seeing that for carrying a gun anywhere in the past 30 days, they were about half as likely for every standard deviation higher in social cohesion of the neighborhood. And these models are all controlling for neighborhood economic deprivation, age, and race ethnicity of the kids. All right, so every study has its limitations. These are cross-sectional data. We were talking about self-reports of weapon carrying. Some of the prevalences were low, especially for gun carrying. Okay, and there may be limited generalizability, just given that this was a Boston High School sample. So the other social processes that we studied, not associated with weapon carrying in this study, which I thought maybe they would be. Collective efficacy, especially the informal social control part, may be important in reducing weapon carrying by youth. Having neighborhoods where people are working together on issues, are watching out for each other, are feeling like there's trust in the neighborhood. There may be something about that that kids are not picking up guns or knives in as high a rate. This agreed with the previous findings that we saw in Chicago, and we saw these gender differences, which are interesting, that the girls' behavior, and you know, it wasn't just a prevalence thing with the knives, because there was a significant number of girls carrying knives, but we did not see these effects of collective efficacy on girls' behavior. And then the question of that I've been thinking about for years now, is it really possible to build up collective efficacy? We see lots of great evidence now for things about doing environmental design, for reducing alcohol outlets, for you know, a lot of community level programming that is really showing a lot of effects. My other hat is I study child abuse and neglect, and really those kinds of things have been, you know, associated with lower child abuse and neglect now. The one really big study where I know of strong communities down at Clemson, they really worked hard and spent a lot of money trying to build up collective efficacy. They got great engagement from the community, and then when they did their surveys, did not see a rise in collective efficacy. So I think it's a really hard thing to build up, but I think it's worth trying. So that's all I have. Daniel?
I wonder, since the early work of Elijah Anderson, some of the ethnographic work indicated that in urban neighborhoods where there was a lot of gun violence, the adults were they were less likely to engage youth and otherwise, you know, do some of the things that are relevant to collective efficacy. So I guess what I was wondering is whether you think it's possible that less gun carrying allows more of these social cohesion and collective efficacy actions to take place, whereas in other neighborhoods where a lot of people are running around with weapons and stuff, people are staying indoors and not engaging people.
So in one of the studies I've done recently on child abuse and neglect, we've looked over time, and the collective efficacy continues over time to over an 11-year period, continues over time to be associated with lower rates of child abuse and neglect. So I'm hopeful that it's in the direction that I think, but of course with cross-sectional data, it could easily be in the direction that you're suggesting, which is the opposite direction.
But on the positive side, if you do interventions to reduce weapon carrying, gun carrying in particular, perhaps, you might also
improve the neighborhood anyway.
It looks as if you built about four different logistic regression models. Can you tell me what the actual p values were on your significant odds ratios? I'm guessing that you did not do a bottom running correction for multiple comparisons, but also appears you only did about four comparisons.
Yeah, so that would be the case. I could show you the tables afterwards if you'd like to see. They were all much below 0.05. I showed the confidence intervals for the ones that were significant, yeah. Yeah. In the back.
I may be misunderstanding something today, but I'm just curious, do the kids who are carrying the weapons or not, do they identify as part of the same community in which you measure the collective efficacy? Because if they don't, or, you know, their community is around their school or around some other organizing framework,
Yeah, that's a great question. So we are talking about the neighborhoods where they live. And so if they do feel like their community is around a different, if they're feeling more connected to a different neighborhood than what we've put them into, then yeah, it would affect the findings. These ones actually were asked of the kids themselves and then aggregated to the neighborhoods. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, thank you.
All right, so thank you all for coming, and let's hear a round of applause for the presenters once more.
majority of people. The majority of people are going to get the head of the gun. That the majority of people are going to be circular. That's what it seemed like. But there's only 603.
Okay, so what I did say.
Yes.
Arrested for something, but you know, saying, I just wanted to.